You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the NL West. I am Allison Footer from MLB.com. As we have anticipated for a while, the NL West race is coming down to probably the last week or a few days of the season. Between the Dodgers and the Giants, it seems to be something that might have been a little bit closer if we had looked at this a week ago, but the Giants sort of fell behind a little bit by losing 2-3 to the Dodgers and then starting off in a bad spot in a series against the Diamondbacks. So while there seems to be a few more games, the discrepancy between the two teams, it's still highly likely that we're going to see both in October, but there's still a lot of baseball to be played. So the next week and a half will be a very interesting scenario in the National League West. And I am joined by one of my esteemed colleagues, Lyle Spencer, who is a columnist for MLB.com and is a Southern California native and or resides there and is all over the Dodgers. So we're happy to have him. Lyle, let's talk a little bit about Clayton Kershaw is just absurd. And I'm wondering, what's in your opinion, him missing the first part of the season with an injury, is that kind of a blessing in disguise? I mean, he's going to be right up against 200 innings pitched anyway, which is remarkable. But you think there's a little preservation there where he's able to maybe endure a little bit more this time of year than other pitchers?
Absolutely. And you've been reading my mind, I think. I've been thinking that all along. It's funny because when I was covering the Lakers years ago, I always used to tell Magic Johnson he should fake an injury about two-thirds of the way through the season to take a week or two off just to let the body, you know, be in better condition for the playoff run. And, you know, I was thinking about that with Kershaw. I think what happened last year, he didn't perform to his level or anywhere close to it in the postseason. I think he was just flamed out from you know, a long season. And he gets deep in games because he's their guy. And I just think, you know, this if they do take it to distance, we'll be able to look back on that as one of the big factors because he wasn't allowed to overextend himself this season.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that pinpointing that particular game in the NLCS last year with Kershaw just not being Kershaw and then Puig kind of being Puig.
Right.
Sort of development in one game. I mean, it's really interesting because he is just as close to unhittable as there is, and that brings us to the next topic, which should be NL MVP. I know there's right. A lot of people with a lot of opinions because should pitchers be up for it? And a lot of people say no because they have their own award. But I think at this point, when you're looking at maybe, you know, Buster Posey being a really good candidate and then sort of on the second tier with Giancarlo Stanton, who unfortunately is out for the season, and Andrew McCutchen, I mean, really, it's all signs seem to be pointing to Kershaw at this point. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm one of those traditionalists who normally likes this award for position players because they're out there every day. But you have to make exceptions for exceptional cases. And this is one of those, you know, one of those Koufax sort of exceptions where this guy's just so far, you know, removed himself from everybody else. And if you think about it, the Dodgers, I believe, are 5 games above 500 when he doesn't start, which is, you know, that was the argument used when Verlander won it in 2011, and I think it applies here. If they don't have Kershaw, they're not even close. And I ran this by Adrian Gonzalez on Sunday up in San Francisco, and before I could even get the question finished, he just says Kershaw, and he said anybody who doesn't wants to make a case for somebody else is just trying to create a story because there's no way. And that's the way his teammates feel. They see what he does, you know, what he means to them. And it really, you know, it really does go beyond once every 5 days. Just having the confidence that this guy's there and you know what he's going to take care of business every 5th day and save your bullpen. And, you know, all those arguments I think are valid in this case.
That's true, because that's a good point. I mean, Mattingly can use his bullpen differently than maybe he would if Kershaw wasn't so dependable, so that he really is affecting other games that he's not even pitching in, because there's a whole manipulation that goes along with it, and it's really helpful for the other four days.
Well, yeah, the game before and the game after. You know, he can tax his bullpen a little more than he normally would. So it's a huge advantage. And yeah, I with all respect to those other guys you mentioned, and I would throw Jonathan LaCroix into that mix as well. I just don't think any of them has had, well, Stanton did, but his team and his condition now kind of probably remove him from it. But I don't think any of those guys had the kind of, you know, just mind-blowing year that would allow them to take it from Kershaw.
Yeah, I think Stan probably would have been, had that not happened, and it's terrible what happened, but had it not happened, I think he's the only other guy, like, when you take him out of that team, and they're not even within 10 games of 500.
Right.
You know, they're just nothing. So I think that probably, I mean, the fact that they're even mentioned, the Marlins were mentioned as contenders this year is pretty remarkable, considering they started over a year ago. Anyway,
and lost Jose Fernandez, who's probably, in my mind, the second best pitcher in the league.
Yeah, that was it was amazing that they lost him so early, and then managed to hang around still, which is bodes well for them in the future. I think that they have a pretty bright future. But staying on the Dodgers, so you've got Matt Kemp, who this is a really good time for him to be taking off. And as I've been talking to some of the other reporters, I mean, there's always somebody, one, two, three guys that have emerged to, you know, solidify things that maybe weren't heavily relied on, or, you know, came out of nowhere or weren't expected to do much. I mean, Matt Kemp, this is certainly something that I doubt the Dodgers could really be floating as much as they are without him in the middle of the lineup.
Absolutely. I think other than Kershaw, he has been the biggest factor in these recent weeks during this nice run they're on, because he's gotten back to being who he is, and I think everybody had doubts, and probably even Matt himself. He had the pretty severe surgery, recoveries from shoulder and ankle surgeries that were both serious injuries, inhibiting him a great deal, and all of a sudden it just came together, and he started being Matt Kemp again. And I think that was just such an emotional lift for everybody, especially in light of the fact that Puig has had this kind of mysterious second-half slump where he's just not driving the ball. And so for Kemp to come in and fill that void, it was huge. And the other guy who has kind of gone unnoticed, but Carl Crawford has been tremendous for about 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, I think his numbers stack up with anybody's in a game over that period, and Carl's given them a lot, and Hanley Ramirez is showing signs of getting back to what he can do. So if you get those three guys rolling, along with Adrian Gonzalez and D. Gordon and the other components in that offense, then now you have a force again offensively to go with their high-caliber pitching.
Puig is an interesting study because, I mean, everyone's talking about, you know, what's going on with him. He has no power, has barely hit any home runs in the last 2 months. And we kind of forget that, you know, he's also really young, really raw. I mean, you know, a guy that might have less of a spotlight on him, that's less of a story, that's been less controversial. I mean, it might just be looked at as a young player, that this is the ups and downs of trying to solidify himself in the major leagues. But because of what Puig did last year, I mean, basically turned the Dodgers season around by himself.
Right.
And
right.
Having so much attention on him that we kind of forget that maybe this is the ebb and flow of what goes on with the young hitter. What do you think?
I agree with that. And, you know, that's why the expression sophomore jinx came into being so many years ago. It's not an unfamiliar thing for a guy to kind of go through struggles in his second season when he's got to start making adjustments, mental adjustments, physical adjustments at the plate, and he's being pitched differently, and, you know, maybe he hasn't made the right adjustments. And I think, like most young hitters who start to struggle, he overcompensated and started kind of going back to his ways of swinging at balls out of the strike zone and helping pitchers out and doing all the things that you don't want to do when you're struggling, rather than trying to take it through the middle and go the other way and, you know, just make solid contact. I think he was probably trying to jack balls, and when you do that, you don't do it. And that's what makes a guy like Mike Trout so remarkable, is that he's the opposite. When he struggles, he becomes overly selective and overly disciplined, which is kind of the reverse of what we're seeing with Puig. So I did see signs this weekend. I thought he hit the ball hard and pretty effectively. He really played well in center field and under control. And you know, if you watch him and, you know, just observe him, he seems like the same guy he was last year. Like, nothing has changed. That, at least emotionally, this slump isn't taking him down and dragging him down, which is a good sign, I think.
Let's end on sort of an interesting topic. I found this fascinating. Don Mattingly challenged a call, I guess a safe call at first base, with leading 13-0.
Right,
and,
yeah.
On a Carl Crawford hit. And so it's kind of an interesting conundrum for the managers, because on one hand, I mean, that's just tacky, you know, when you're up by 13
right.
runs and you're challenging. But at the other hand, you want to take up your player, and they want their hits. I mean, they want to be credited with the hit if they can possibly
for
do
sure.
it. So how is that received by the other team? Do you think that's sort of a new thing, a new sort of topic to talk about, because these are the sort of the things that are going to emerge with some of the new rules? And
right.
I think he even went out and said to the umpire, "I'm really sorry, I don't want to do this, but I have to," or something like that.
Yeah, he did. And Mattingly the next day, you know, mentioned that, you know, he felt reluctant to do it, given everything that you just mentioned, but he felt he had to do it, because the reality is, in today's world, every hit, and there was an RBI involved in that too. And so it's important to the player, you know, that's his livelihood, and you know, it makes a difference. It's, you know, I've seen guys, Torrey Hunter one year was one hit short of hitting 300, he hit 299 in 2009, and one more hit, and he hit 300. So, you know, it was a kind of a strange situation, but fortunately, it happened against one of the most rational and understanding managers in the sport, in Bruce Bochy, who also is able to, understand that, you know, that circumstances have changed, you know, and there are new set of rules. And Bosch talked about this the next day as well. He said in that position, he'd have done the same thing very reluctantly, because you have to show your players that you're behind them. That overrides everything else.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, it didn't seem to create any controversy, so
no.
I think everybody was happy.
Yeah, that's all we really care about, ultimately.
Exactly. All right. Well, Lyle, thank you so much for being with us. It was a nice treat to have you pinch hitting for Ken Grant. So appreciate that. And we'll be probably talking to you down the road. I will soon be joined by my colleague, Chris Haft, who covers the Giants for MLB.com. And as we enter the final stretch of the regular season, looking at the schedule, you would think that the Giants would be sitting in a pretty good spot. And even though they have three more games against the Dodgers, they also have some division games against the Diamondbacks and the Padres, and this would be a good time to make up a little bit of ground in the division race, or maybe gain a little bit more in the wild card race. But they first have to beat these lesser teams, and that might be a challenge, because the Giants have run into a few injury issues and also have lost a few games in a row. So let's talk about that with Chris. Chris, let's start with the Giants having lost three in a row. Which is not what they wanted to do, but of course they went against Greinke, Kershaw, and then Wade Miley with the Diamondbacks. So sometimes you're only as good as you are against a really, really good pitcher, and these guys have had some problems. So what's the feeling? Are they kind of getting a little bit of panic, or they're kind of taking things in stride? How's the mood right now?
I think they're taking things in stride, Allison. Most of these people have been through pennant races before, and of course a handful of them were with either one or the other or both of the Giants championship teams in 2010 and 2012. So there's no panic. I can't say there's any panic in the clubhouse. I think they're probably kicking themselves a little bit over last night, even though, you know, you look at it on paper, 6-2, they lost the Diamondbacks. That's not a really close game, but there goes an opportunity to, pick up some ground. In this case, it would have been on the wild card side of things because the Dodgers won at Colorado, so there's no way that San Francisco would have picked up on them. But, Bruce Bochy likes to say, I guess all managers do, but more people listen to Bruce since he's been so successful. Every day is a big game, especially at this time of the year, and so that makes tonight a really essential game. Even though the D-backs have what a 4-10 or 4-12 winning percentage at this point in the year, when you're a contender, you just can't take anybody lightly.
And really, I mean, it's kind of overblown when you look at like quote unquote strength of schedule. That's more like a football thing to me. I mean, you can be playing a really bad team and you can have their ace. And then, that ace might beat you. And it's really just so much, it just has so much to do with pitching matchups more than anything. So the D-backs, I mean, they've had their problems, but they're certainly not to be taken lightly.
You're absolutely right. If your eight players are better than my eight players, but my pitcher happens to be better than yours on a particular night, there's a really good chance I'm going to win, and that's part of the beauty of baseball, the unpredictability. Right now, it threatens to drive the Giants nuts, but because the starting pitching is a little bit unpredictable. They've got Vogelsong pitched a fairly solid game last night, but Tim Hudson has kind of struggled through September. You can't rubber Jake Peavy, as solid as he has been throughout his career. He's at a point now where you can't really rubber stamp, a victory when he goes to the mound. And Mero Petit hasn't, even though he's pitched some superb games, as everybody knows, here recently. I mean, you really don't know 100% what you're going to get from him either. So there you go.
Right. Well, it's funny, ironic, not funny, because this is not funny to the Giants whatsoever, but ironic that we were just talking about what Angel Pagan, how he can change the landscape of a team just by either being healthy and in the lineup or being sidelined with issues. And, of course, we saw that he had, I guess, a scratch from Monday's game with the back tightening, back soreness. So what can you tell us about that, and what can happen if he's not healthy? How does that sort of change the whole dynamic of the lineup?
He's hoping, and the Giants are hoping, that he can play today. The back stiffness, you can tell it's been bothering him for a while because he approached a couple of plays in center field during last weekend series against the Dodgers a little tentatively, not the way he normally would charge after him. And so, again, you can tell the back issue has been bothering him. But yes, they do need him in the lineup. He is a catalyst, and so he's working overtime on this to try and work himself into playable shape. If he doesn't play, probably Gregor Blanco will bat lead off. That's what Bruce Bochy indicated last night. So, Gregor's played well in spurts during the stretch. So. They'd have to hope that if Angel doesn't play, they can get a reasonable facsimile from Gregor.
I think that when you see injuries this time of year, a lot of the players will say, well, if this was May, I would probably take a little bit more time off. But because of where we are right now, you sort of have to try to accelerate things a little bit. And it sounds like that might be what's happening right now. Maybe if this was 3 months ago, there'd be, he's been sidelined, so... you think maybe he's just going to try to push through it until he just can't anymore?
He might have to. He's played, sat down, figured it out. I hope my calculations were correct. Entering last night, he had played 30 out of 32 games since missing 44 games with back inflammation. So, last night makes 30 out of 33, a pretty good percentage. But, now here in these final, with 12 games to go, they need their best lineup out there every day.
So I was reading some of your coverage, and it's funny because when you look around baseball and a lot of the teams that are in contention that have had just amazing runs as the, you know, in the final weeks of the season. I mean, I look at the Angels as an example, that they've had so many devastating injuries, not just little things here and there, but just losing like 2/5 of the rotation, and other people have stepped up, and that's the unexpected contributors factor. And the Giants, they've had some of that too. So, and we've talked about the second baseman, Joe Panik, before. They were kind of, I mean, he kind of forced their hand. I mean, San Francisco was forced to turn to him after they had really tried almost everything else, including a disastrous four-game experiment with Dan Uggla. So let's talk about a little bit about just the kind of the unsung heroes, the unexpected contributors, Panik, and then a backup catcher having to step in when Hector Sanchez has some concussions. So what has that factor, how has that factor helped the Giants?
It definitely has helped the Giants. I think we've, Allison talked a lot about Joe Panik, as you said. He's emerged as a Rookie of the Year candidate. At that, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that. I think Billy Hamilton is the clear favorite because he's played more of the season. But about a half century ago, Willie McCovey won the Rookie of the Year award for the Giants after playing in only 52 or 54 games. The exact number escapes me right now. So. Not
wow.
That Joe Panik's a Willie McCovey, but, I mean, there is a precedent, a precedent wearing a Giants uniform. Travis Ishikawa has helped out a lot. Giants fans remember him from, you know, 2010 in the late 2000s, but he played on a 2010 World Series team. He's had some timely hits, including a couple of pinch hits, so there's an unsung hero right there. Matt Duffy has done the same thing for them with some key hits off the bench. And as you mentioned before, Andrew Susak, the backup catcher, has really, really stepped up. I mean, he's played himself into the picture. It's an understatement to say he's played himself into the picture for 2015.
And this recent Dodger series was wacky. I can't even – I don't think that anybody expected for there to be 2 football scores and then actually a normal game when you're talking about 2 of the best teams in baseball, really. So what was going through your mind? I mean, there was a lot happening in losing 17-0 to the Dodgers. You'd think that there wasn't much going on, but what, I mean, did Lincecum pitch in that game and Bruce Bochy's son pitch in that game and nobody was doing really well, but what was your reaction to that weekend? There was such buildup and then those first 2 games were just crazy.
For me, it was almost a turnabout as fair play type of thing, Allison. The night before, the Giants had won 9-0. And last year, when the Giants were struggling, playing out the string, so to speak, at about this time, they beat the Dodgers in Chavez Ravine at something like 18-3 and set a bunch of records, you know, ballpark records in the process. So the same thing happened with the Giants on the receiving end and the Dodgers on the dealing end, you know, at AT&T Park. It was totally flip sides of the same coin. So, I mean, I don't know, if you had a dollar for every time somebody shrugs his shoulders and says, that's baseball, to explain things, I mean, we'd all be pretty rich. And you know what? You have to shrug your shoulders and say, that's baseball. I mean, it's just, it's the expect the unexpected almost is kind of what went on there.
Yeah, those are the kind of scores that you expect to see sometimes maybe July, August. I don't know. I mean, guys do get tired. It just seemed strange to me that it would be happening this time of year. Everyone's kind of amped up. The pitchers are ready to go, you know, and I don't know, 2 straight shutouts with just lopsided. But it was kind of fun to talk about. So, and so now we just watch, and they've got a bunch of games coming up with the Padres, and, of course, another really, I guess, heavily anticipated Dodger series. So we will keep track of that, and we will talk to you again next week. Thank you very much, Chris. I am joined by my colleague, Corey Brock, who covers the Padres for MLB.com, and we are at that point in the season. Well, I keep saying this every week, but until the season's over, I'm going to keep saying it. We're at that point of the season where the games are dwindling down and the calendar is flipping to October, and some of the teams that aren't so much in the division race are starting to look toward next year, or maybe their golf games in November or their off-season home. Whatever they feel like doing, the Padres are almost finished. But they do have some games to play, and they can play spoiler for some of these contending teams in the NL West. And there have been some interesting things that have been going on with the Padres lately. So let's bring in Corey Brock. Corey, Being a Houstonian, I was laughing very loudly at some of the game coverage that the – and I realized that San Diego is – there is some severe weather, some severely hot weather. But I think it was like 81 degrees last night, and everyone was freaking out because there was humidity. This would be, of course, an open roof game in Houston. Everyone would be celebrating the break in temperature. But this was a little bit unusual, I guess, for the fans and for the Padres to be playing in such high temperatures, would you say?
I'm always careful, Allison, about complaining about the weather here, just because realizing that, you know, how good we have it here. But, yeah, this is kind of an we've been in this extreme heat wave, I guess. And, of course, the ballpark is sitting next to a large body of water known as the Pacific Ocean. So if it's not cool down there, it's not cool anywhere. So, yeah, it's been pretty warm. But, yeah, you're right. Probably you have this weather in Houston. People are trying to figure out what kind of a sweatshirt they should bring to the game or blanket, thinking at some point they're going to be kind of cool. But, yeah, people are babies here. Let's just go ahead and just come right out and say it, that when this happens – people are babies. So, no, it's been a little uncomfortable, but people will get through it somehow. And in January, when they're wearing flip-flops and barbecuing outside, they'll have a nice laugh about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we should all have those problems to have to suffer through this. But, hey, it's something to talk about. So, so Andrew Cashner, I found this very interesting. So he basically has a no-hitter going until the fifth inning. And there was a situation where Dominic Brown, so he bunts with one out down the third baseline. There's a no-hitter going on. So maybe normally in past years this would be a little bit of a controversy, or he would, you know, that Cashner would maybe have a beef that there was a bunt attempt to get that first out of the game. But now in this, modern day of shifting, I think it's a little bit different. Well, it's a lot different, and you really can't dictate anymore. So he basically pushes a bunt where there's nobody standing because there was a heavy shift on Brown, and everybody was lined up on the right side of the infield. So Bud Black had no problem with it. Cashner seemed to have a few issues with it. But where do you stand on that? What was your reaction when you heard about that?
Yeah, I think it's all fair game. You're right, Allison, in this era that we're living in now with these extreme shifts, and if you have to understand that if you're going to do that, and knowing that the pitcher is going to pitch to the shift, I think we have to understand also that the extreme infield alignment, you're going to see the pitcher also has to execute his pitch and has to pitch to the shift, meaning that if you're going to slant one way or the other with your infielders, your pitcher's not going to pitch the other way and make it easier for the hitter. So he has to pitch to a certain point. And, and again, it's a very tight game too. I think that's an added component to this. You know, mm-hmm. if this is an 8-0 game, maybe the Padres are looking at things a little differently, but the Phillies, and sure they're out of it too, like the Padres, but they're trying to win a game here, and they're trying to get something going, trying to get some base runners. So, I think in the grand scheme of things, it's not a big deal. So, trying to get a base runner on, trying to start something, trying to beat the shift. And if you're going to give me that room over there, I'm going to try and exploit it.
Yeah. And I think there was an incident early in the season with Houston, which is what kind of sticks out of my mind, but just this whole thing about the unwritten rules and losing your mind, respecting this and that. I mean, I think that's going to go out the window because if I'm a left-handed hitter in the major leagues and there's a gaping hole over there and they're all standing where I normally hit the ball, I'm pushing a bunt down there. I really don't care what the situation is. I really don't care if my team is up 8-0 and it's the seventh inning. I mean, just we do not have to play into your rules. Like, we don't have to hit into your shifts. And you're doing everything possible because really, if the differential, which, this was not the case with the Padres, but just theoretically speaking, if there's a huge differential in the score, then why are you shifting anyway? And so I think over time, we're going to see some of this completely go away, kind of this unwritten rule thing, which I can't wait. I will celebrate the day that nobody ever mentions another unwritten rule in baseball.
Well, and it's true. And I think you hit on a good point there, Allison. If you're going to accept the responsibility of, okay, we're going to undertake this kind of quirky defensive alignment here because you've shown through, you know, advanced scouting, we've done our homework here, and that more often than not, you're going to hit the ball on, let's say, the right side of the infield, and we're going to stack our infielders over there. If you beat us the other way, if you find a way to push the ball through the left side, then you beat us. You beat us fair and square, and you have to understand that there's a flip side to this, and that you've left yourself very vulnerable on the other side there, and I just don't think you can get upset about that.
Yeah, and if I'm a hitter, I mean, they're team players, but their individual numbers do mean something, and I'm just not really going to want a 250 average if I can hit 275. I mean, that's just kind of how it is. You know, these guys, they have contracts to work for and livelihoods to work for, and so I'm doing whatever I can to get my hits, even if I have to do it unconventionally. But on a happier note, I mean, Cashner, wow, what an outing. So, I mean, he had missed 2 months with a sore arm, and he's still kind of pushing through those kinds of things. This is his fifth start back after missing all that time. So that had to be encouraging just from the Padres' standpoint to see this going on this late in the season with someone that they're depending on.
Yeah, I think a big development for them, Allison. He talked about, you know, he had two disabled list stints this year, a shorter one with a sore elbow and then kind of a longer one with kind of a sore right shoulder, you know, no structural damage at all, but, you know, just gave him some time. And he's been very good since he came back. And, you know, he talked really about the importance of making each one of these starts count when he came back, even though we're into these dog days now where the Padres are kind of playing out the string here, but you know, don't tell that to him. You know, he wants to finish strong and kind of use this as a springboard into next season. You know, this is a guy that, you know, they're really going to lean heavily on moving forward. The guy with dynamite stuff. If we go back to the month of April, you know, 2 weeks into the season, this guy throws a one-hit shutout against the Tigers at Petco Park. You know, a guy with dynamite stuff, and when you pair him with Tyson Ross, who took a huge step forward this year in a developmental standpoint, and Ian Kennedy, who is very good, this is a very good rotation. You know, the Padres' shortcoming, Allison, as we've discussed over and over again, certainly are injuries and underperformance, especially offensively, but there's nothing wrong with those top three in the rotation. So they're very excited about Andrew Cashner, what he has to offer. And they still feel like this is a guy, you know, who is still kind of scratching the surface, kind of like with Tyson Ross, of what he can be as a starter. You know, this guy was a reliever with the Cubs, kind of like with Ross was, you know, he kind of shuttled back and forth between the rotation and the bullpen with the A's, and is still kind of growing as a starter and still kind of learning how to use all his pitches, save a few of his bullets, refine a few of his pitches. So a very exciting development last night, especially for how efficient as he was. 92 pitches over 9 innings, that's very exceptional.
So if you had to pinpoint one thing, which is an unfair question, but I'm asking it anyway, looking at the Padres in the offseason and heading into spring training next year, if there's one major thing that they absolutely have to do, they absolutely have to address, that can be the biggest difference maker for next year's team, what should be their number one priority?
Well, it has to be offense. They have to find a way to bolster their offense. And, you know, there's not one specific area, I guess you could look at that as a good or bad thing, where they need to find some upgrades. Find some power for the corners, first and third base. You could find some for the outfield. What do you do with Everett Cabrera at shortstop? Rene Rivera is a nice story behind the plate at catcher, especially defensively. I think they're fine there. But, you know, their position players, their everyday position players, they need upgrades there. And I'm not quite sure how they're going to go about doing that. You know, remember now we have the Padres here have a new general manager in A.J. Preller, and you know, he's been on the job for just a little over a month now and had a chance to kind of evaluate not just the major league roster, but the farm system, which isn't quite ready to, produce anything in terms of help on the way for next year for position players. So, you know, I think what's going to happen, and I think know, I was just going on and on about how wonderful the starting pitching was, Allison, with Ross, Cashner, and Kennedy. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they parted with one of those guys in order to find themselves an offensive upgrade. You know, the Padres are never going to be a team that dabbles really heavily in the free agent market. You know, it's awfully spendy. That's a lot of, you know, talk about risk reward in terms of how much you have to give up, especially on the back end of some of these contracts. I think it's just the cost is a little bit too steep for them. I think they may have to part with something in order to find some offensive upgrades. So it's been interesting for me to kind of watch these last few weeks here and see a lot of young guys come up and, you know, try and figure out, are these guys going to be part of the big league roster for next year? And I have a feeling that 25-man roster, especially the 13 position players or whatever it will be, is going to look far different than it does right now.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it. But first, we have to finish out this season. It could get very interesting for the Padres if they want to play spoiler, because they have a ton of games left against the Giants. So we will keep our eye on that. And thank you, Corey. We'll talk to you next week. I am joined by my colleague, Steve Gilbert, the longtime beat writer for the Arizona Diamondbacks for MLB.com. And what else are we going to talk about besides the GM search, which is actually getting very interesting? So Tony La Russa, the, whatever his title is, chief presidential officer of the Diamondbacks, has been tasked
Chief baseball
with...
officer.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you. He's been tasked with finding a new general manager, and he started with 10 candidates. It seems to be maybe whittling down a little bit, and I'm still very intrigued by this Dave Stewart factor here. So let's talk to Steve for a second. And, Steve, what can you tell us? What's the latest on this GM search, and are there any front runners that have emerged?
Well, Alpha, I think, you know, still Dave Stewart is kind of considered a front runner just because of his relationship with Tony and the way Tony feels about him. And Tony really likes the experience that Dave's had, both as, you know, obviously a player, but also as a pitching coach and then as an assistant general manager and now as a player agent. So he's kind of a unique background, and Tony seems to be impressed with that. Plus there's LaRocque with the Cardinals, who Tony's worked with in the past, the guy he's comfortable with and who has a pretty good resume. So those two have always kind of been the seemingly front runners, if there is such a thing. And Tony's supposed to cut that list down to two or three candidates that he's going to bring in front of Derek Hall and Ken Kendrick for them to talk to as well. So probably middle of this week, I've heard, is the target date for him to have that done as far as finalists. And then next week he could have hire a general manager.
Wow. I mean, does it seem to be moving quickly? I mean, you've been following it on a daily basis. They wanted to get it done before the end of the season. Is there a particular reason why? Do you feel like it's being rushed at all, or is it just kind of the process?
I think he's going through his process. I think, you know, he has a good idea in mind what he was looking for from a general manager, and I think he's been pretty quickly going through the list of names that he had. The reason they want to have it done before the end of the season is they'd like to have a decision made on Kirk Gibson by the time the season ends. And even though Tony has said he's going to have the final say on who and whether or not the manager stays or goes, he would like the general manager to have significant input. So they want to have that person in place by the end of the year to be able to talk to him, to be able to have some input and discussion as far as that goes. And also they want to hit the ground running as far as the acquiring free agents and doing whatever that they're going to be doing during the offseason and kind of have a direction set and have a person in place so they can get a jump on things in October.
Oh, that makes sense then. So I guess we'll just have to keep our – I mean, it's just amazing because it's at the end of the season. It's not so far away anymore. When I'm talking about, you know, it sort of becomes this thing that never seems to get here, and all of a sudden everyone's down to like a dozen more games. So – I guess things could get pretty interesting around there all of you guys.
Not that any of us have been counting here on counting down days or anything like that.
Oh, I know. Covering a playoff contender is really fun, but when you're not covering a playoff contender, it's just like that October 1st is just like a glorious day when you can just kind of go to sleep.
Yes, and Allison, you can appreciate this too. When you go to Australia to start a season, you start a season early, then Diamondbacks report on February 5th this year as opposed to the usual, you know, middle of the month. So it's been a long season for the Diamondbacks and anyone who has followed them, that's for sure.
That's a very good point. I didn't even think about that your offseason ended abruptly, a lot earlier than usual. So somebody who is going to be spending this offseason recovering from surgery would be Brad Ziegler. So he was supposed to have some kind of routine surgery, I mean, if you can call it that, on his knee, and then it became more serious than expected. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, he'd been experiencing some discomfort in his left knee. He felt it earlier in June during June 27th, pregame, doing a conditioning drill. He kind of felt a little something in that knee. And he kept pitching on it right up until, a couple weeks ago. And whether or not he did some more damage to it by pitching on it, I guess we'll never really fully know. But he wanted to try to tough it out. And it was kind of amazing that he was able to do that against his land leg as a pitcher, that's the leg he lands on. But they went in hopeful that maybe it was just needing some minor arthroscopic type cleanup work in there, and ended up having to do microfracture surgery, which was a little more serious, not, anything career-threatening or anything of that nature, but the recovery time is going to be a little bit longer. He's hoping that he can be ready to go when spring training opens next year. But the recovery process, obviously, for microfracture surgery is more significant than it would be had it just been like arthroscopic cleanup.
Vidal Nuno, I'm kind of like... kind of becoming obsessed with this situation here. still looking for that first National League win. I mean, this is becoming, like, ridiculous. He's 0-6 in 12 starts, and he lost his last start. I mean, he didn't pitch that well, so this is kind of, 6 runs in 5 innings. So it's not like it's just hard luck all the time. But this is getting a little ridiculous. I mean, is it important for him to at least get that win and before the season is over and just kind of know that he was able to do that before – his offseason starts, or do you think it's going to affect him one way or another?
I don't know if it will affect him one way or the other, but it's one of those things where I know that wins don't mean what we used to think that they meant. With advanced metrics now and the way we look at the game of baseball, wins are not as important anymore. However, it's still right there on your stat line. It's the first part of your stat line that people see. And so to be sitting there with a big donut hole in the win column, I think is not something that anybody would want, especially since, as you pointed out, there aside from his last outing and maybe one or two others, he's pitched really, really well and really deserved to have a few victories, if not at least one. So, yeah, I think it's something that they would like to see him get a win just to kind of – so the storyline goes away because it seems like it's a regular thing now. Every time he pitches, they talk about, he hasn't won a game since coming over the Diamondbacks. And, you just don't like those kinds of things to kind of fester and to have a little bit of the momentum of their own.
It's interesting that you bring that up because some of my Saber nerd friends in Houston, we've had these discussions, and wins do not mean the same. Pitcher wins do not mean the same as they used to, and that's for sure with advanced metrics and all the different ways that we can dissect a guy's performance. But wouldn't you agree that it means something still to the pitcher? I'm not talking about, like, to the extreme of Nuno, who's just got a big goose egg there in the win column. But wouldn't you say that for pitchers still, the modern-day pitcher, a win does mean a little bit more than the Saber guys would perhaps want it to?
I think so, just because it's just like we've grown up with certain stats like average home runs, RBIs. Now, maybe it'll be different for the next generation of pitchers who grow up, with all the advanced metric stats, and so they're not as accustomed to it. But I know when you and I were growing up, it was, average homers, RBIs for a guy, and it was wins, losses, ERA for a pitcher, and now we know so much more. But, yeah, so I think for this current generation, sure, they like to see those wins by their names, and I think that it's a pride thing too. You want to go out there and you want to at least to pitch well enough for that win, and it's always nice to rack up as many of those as you can.
Let's look at the rotation a little bit. There, the D-backs sort of have a 6-man rotation going on right now, but some guys are coming up against or have surpassed their career highs for innings pitched. And there's been some call-ups that have been made lately, so we might see maybe Anderson might be surpassed on his or passed up on his next turn. So what would you think is going to happen in the next week and a half where some of these guys might just be shut down?
Yeah, I think that they're discussing the Chase Anderson situation now just because he's pitched so many innings and he's surpassed where he was last year. And, on the one hand, they want him to pitch deep into September, so next year he's prepared to do that. On the other hand, they don't want to risk injury with him, and there's really no reason to do that at this point. He's had a really nice year, so it wouldn't surprise me if they shut him down. He's still scheduled to make his next start, but that's tentative, so we'll have to see. But they really want to work Andrew Chafin into the rotation to give him one more start. They just called him up. He's the guy you're referring to that they just called up from AAA, and they were impressed with what he did in his five-inning stint earlier this year in the second game of a doubleheader when he was called up to start that game. And they'd like to reward him with one more start and just kind of see what he can do. So it would make sense because they're almost exactly lined up that Chase Anderson would be skipped at least his next turn and let Andrew Chafin pitch. But we'll have to see how they manage to work Chafin into the rotation.
So I'm watching the footage, some of the highlights from the game last night, and, of course, I'm seeing this in slow motion. So you made this, amazing catch on a foul ball in the press box. And it looks so effortless in slow motion because you have plenty of time to stand up and get your hands positioned just so. It looked like this is just second nature to you. So did your heart stop when it was coming right at your face, or what was going on there?
You know, it happened so quick, I didn't really have time to think, and I think that's the key. The more time you have to think, just like an infielder fielding a grounder, when they have extra time, and then they throw it over the first baseman's head as opposed to a bang-bang play when you don't have time to think. So that was probably working in my favor. Ironically, Allison, the last time I caught a ball in the press box was last year, and I had a gentleman sitting next to me that had been on an auction to follow me around for the evening, and that same charity did that last again this year, and last night was the night that I had the guy sitting next to me. So I think that's going to be part of the charity thing. You can follow me around for a night and get a foul ball handed to you in the press box.
If I had a guy that paid money to follow me around, I'd call the cops, but I guess that's a different and so you have bragging rights at the next MLB.com holiday party because, of course, you made the catch and Mark Sheldon just watched his computer go kapooey because he just, I guess, doesn't have the same reflexes as you do.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give Din a call and see if I can get a bonus for the laptop that we didn't have to have replaced because I actually made the catch there. I'll have to work on that.
Exactly. You'll be the MVP of the party. Anyway, Steve, thank you so much. It was always highly entertaining, as usual, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you. I am joined by my very good friend Thomas Harding, who has relentlessly covered these Colorado Rockies all season long and is still smiling and still standing strong. So we're happy about that. But let's bring in Thomas right now. Thomas, you're one of my favorite people, and for many, many reasons. But one is the lead that you had in your game story the other day. You can't spell dysfunction without fun. You were actually talking about the Dodgers, but it could really apply to the Rockies, too. So
yes, it can, although they're not having as much fun with their dysfunction as the Dodgers are, but yes.
I found that in my years of covering the Astros that I had a lot easier time writing game stories when the Astros stunk than when they had a really well-pitched game with some timely hits. It was a lot more fun, not like it was fun for the fans, but it was fun for me to write stories when they were just terrible. So not to bag on the team or anything, but do you find that those are when your creative juices can really get flowing a little bit?
Not exactly, but I will say that a team that's in the middle is very hard to write about because it's very much in the middle. If a team is doing quite well or quite poorly, then a lot of times the stories are better. It seems like the extremes are what get writers' juices flowing. It's not necessarily a bad team or a great team, but it's either of those. When you're in between, that's when you really have to work hard to come up with the words.
Yeah, that's very true. I would agree with that 100% because when teams are going for a pennant, when they're deep in the race and there's a million things going on all the time and every injury means something or every home run means something, And that's really fun to write about, but when they're just, you know, god-awful, that can also be pretty interesting, too. But let's move to Walt Weiss is stumping for two Gold Glove candidates on this team. So the infield looks well represented. I was reading some of your coverage, and he really – I mean, I guess Nolan Arenado, he's really kind of a favorite, I guess, to win a Gold Glove at third base. And also second baseman, DJ LeMahieu. They both are leading their positions with defensive runs saved. And other things that I don't understand, like ultimate zone rating. But so that's kind of nice to have, you know, two candidates from that team that really have a pretty legitimate shot.
Yeah, in fact, last year, Arenado won the award as a rookie, first National League rookie third baseman to do it. And LeMahieu, who had a very solid year, but no one really talked about it, he ended up being the Wilson Defensive Player of the Year, where they take all those stats that you don't understand, and MLB.com and MLB Network put together a show based on them. And he was the Rockies' best defensive player on an average. I mean, listen, if Troy Tulowitzki were still playing, I would think that he would be definitely up for the Gold Glove right now. I know that the UZR rating, which I still don't fully understand, in a couple of seasons, or at least last season, it really played up Adelton Simmons of the Atlanta Braves. But if you look at the overall stats, especially when Tulowitzki went out, he was clearly the best shortstop there, but he hasn't played enough for it. I like the idea of Arenado winning another Gold Glove. I mean, if anything, when the voters look at it, all of them, it seems, have been victimized by a great play by Arenado out there, and the stats do back it up. LeMahieu would be great if he were to win a Gold Glove. Really would. He's had a very up and down season offensively. He put up a very good average early in the season, then went through a horrendous slump, and now he's battling back a little bit. So as we know, that Gold Glove, a lot of times, if a guy is not performing offensively, no matter what he does defensively, it is very hard to win that. That's a recent development. I don't like it very much, but I can see Walt Weiss stumping for LeMahieu also.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. I mean, being a good hitter helps. I mean, Arenado, that's going to help. It shouldn't, and it's ridiculous. And I've had an issue with the whole voting system because I don't think that – I think it's the managers and the coaches that vote on it, and I don't think that they spend enough time really poring over the numbers and drawing on their own, you know, kind of observations. And it's kind of a flawed system. And I, having seen sort of, you know, been on the PR side when I have to give the staff the ballots, I mean, it's, you know, they're voting in September, they're exhausted, they're cranky, they're either like immersed in a pennant race themselves, or they're 80 games out of first place and they just want it to be over. And I don't know that they give enough time to the voting system. And I think that, you know, that's not always fair. They're sort of like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. He's a good hitter, so I'm going to mark him down. I mean, it seems to happen a lot.
Yeah, it does happen, although I believe it was last season was the first year they added a sabermetric component to it, which will even it out somewhat. I don't know that it evens it out totally. And really, I didn't compare last season to maybe what it would have been in previous seasons. Most of the time, the people who are watching this, they do know who the good players are. Where you run into a problem is, yeah, the hitting, where it seems like if a guy is more feared with the bat, you remember him more at Gold Glove time. And also the highlight plays. There are players who make highlight plays but really aren't that good a player because maybe they don't position themselves properly or they don't make the routine plays. I think if you look at LeMahieu and also Arenado, those guys are above reproach when it comes to those two categories that are really important if you're a defensive player over a 162-game season.
Yeah, I'm glad that they have advanced metrics that they're incorporating in this to evaluate because errors are – it's just a silly statistic when you're trying to decide, you know, fielding percentage. It's goofy because if everything's going by you for a hit, you're not getting to the balls, and your fielding percentage is high. I mean, that doesn't tell me anything. And so I think that part is antiquated. So it's nice to see it that at least that they're being a little bit more accurate when it comes to actually what kind of fielder that you are.
Well, I think they're paying more attention to it now. I don't know about the accuracy of all of the stats. There are some of the stats that are very individually based, meaning they're trying to rate the individual ability to get to a ball and also put away the play. But there's a team component to this also. It's where you're playing at the time of the pitch. Does the pitcher get the ball to where he wants to get it? That is one of the biggest things, and that is one of the arguments I would have for LeMahieu, is that more so than almost any second baseman that I've covered here, what I hear about him is that he can read how his pitcher is pitching and the swing of the batter. If you look at the Rockies infield with LeMahieu, we're talking about Gold Glove with him. Justin Morneau's been very good at first base. Tulowitzki's a Gold Glover at short, and Arenado at third base. They do have all the positioning stats that a lot of the other teams do, but actually they turn it over to LeMahieu and Tulowitzki to position the guys. Tulowitzki spent last year positioning Arenado because they have a feel for how that pitcher is pitching. And Lord knows the Coors Field, and with the staff that the Rockies sometimes have to throw out there, you really have to think on your feet. It's not just you follow a scouting report, because sometimes the pitcher doesn't pitch to the scouting report, or sometimes a guy will come in and maybe he's hot or he's cold, and that will change his swing. And that's one of the things that LeMahieu and Tulowitzki are very good at. Tulowitzki actually watches the last few films of various hitters just to see how they're swinging the bat at that time to make sure that it jives or doesn't jive with the scouting report.
Wow. Well, that's very complicated. So let's simplify things a little bit. Let's move on to pace of game issues.
Oh, boy.
Interesting. I wanted to hear, like, your opinions on this, because you cover a team that plays in what everyone considers to be the birthplace of the four-hour game for many, 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 many reasons. And, of course, they have, I mean, the Rockies with the humidor, and they've taken measures to sort of make things a little bit more fair there. But the Atlantic League, the Independent League, they've taken it upon themselves really to experiment with pace of game and make recommendations that could possibly help the major leagues. And a couple things that they've been experimenting with. Teams are limited to 3 45-second timeouts for 9 innings. Those include mound visits from the managers, coaches, catchers, or an infielder that doesn't result in a pitching change. Umpires are asked to be more diligent to enforce the restrictions on batters stepping out of the box. They want the pitchers to deliver the ball in 12 seconds when bases are occupied. They want umpires to stick to the strike zone and pitchers to just throw 6 warm-up pitches instead of 8. Some of these are already, like, things that are already supposed to be enforced and aren't. So I wanted to ask your opinion on some of that. I mean, it seems to have worked. It's shaved off several minutes of some of these games, and I think everyone's interested in making these games a little bit more interesting, keeping the fans engaged. As time goes on, people's attention spans seem to be shrinking a little bit. So, what's your opinion on that, and how do you think that could translate to the big league?
Well, to begin with, the talk about people's attention span shrinking, I'm not sure that that's a valid thing here, because the games have actually gotten longer over the years. So maybe the attention span is the same. It's just, gee, these games are taking forever. There are a couple of those that I really like. Cutting the number of warm-up pitches to 6 as opposed to 8. I don't think that you need 8 pitches. Well, I would almost say, maybe there's a sliding scale here where the umpire could say, hey, that was a long inning. Maybe you get a couple of more warm-up pitches, and that's fine. I like that, although in the Atlantic League it works a little better than the Major Leagues, because the Major Leagues has television, and you're coming back from a TV timeout and commercials, and I'm not sure you can really get that done. I love the 45-second timeout thing, because I see teams where there is a summit meeting on the mound seemingly after every pitch. I've watched some Yankees games where I swear that Derek Jeter has spent more time on the mound than the starting pitcher. You see that all over baseball. Here in Colorado, William Rosario, the catcher there, a relatively young catcher, and it seems like there have been some miscommunications with pitchers on the mound, so he's always going out there. And I think not only does that destroy the pace of the game, but it also destroys the pitcher's concentration and the defense also. So I think it would actually help teams perform better. So those are the ones that I really like. Now, when it comes to enforcing keeping the batters in the batter's box, good luck with that, I think. Hopefully you can do that, but it seems like there are some very good hitters who are human rain delays. I remember Mike Hargrove back years ago. He was the human rain delay. Troy Tulowitzki has definitely taken that spot with the Velcro and the gloves. I think if they outlawed Velcro, the hitters would stay in the box more because after every pitch they have to pull off and put on the Velcro. I'm not sure what that does for them, but all of them do it. I would imagine that what happened, they saw someone do it on TV, so they all copy it.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the Velcro because that's one thing that they had on the table to experiment with or suggest or recommend, and that was to eliminate Velcro batting gloves. That was soon thrown out the window.
Velcro's probably added, like, I'd say, a minute and a half to every game played all across the majors, maybe even more than that. Maybe it's been like 5 minutes, 5 minutes of Velcro.
Yeah, if Nomar Garciaparra were still playing and these rules were enforced, he'd have to basically retire. I don't know that he would that he would be able to handle any of that. So on the Rockies, I mean, Troy Tulowitzki might have a problem with that. He seems to be a kind of a quirky routine sort of guy when it comes to being at the plate.
Yeah, he is. I mean, it's not just the Velcro; it's the walking around the dirt, sometimes on the grass, taking extra swings. And also with the Rockies, they have Jorge De La Rosa, who seems to take forever to throw a pitch. Now, I remember having a conversation with Jorge saying, and we were talking about the pace of game, and his immediate thought was, I don't destroy the pace of game. It's the hitters and their Velcro batting gloves. It's like, good grief, it's like the turtle calling the snail slow. But if he ever faced Tulowitzki, I don't think a pitch would be thrown. And then if you got to the ninth inning, Rafael Betancourt, who's been injured this year, I think they hope to have him back next year. He takes forever. A lot of closers take forever to throw a pitch because they don't hold runners very well, so they stand there holding the baseball. So, yeah, you've got to find a way to speed that thing up, especially when games get tight.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting because players are such creatures of routine, and I can imagine that it would be very difficult to have to make these adjustments while they're actually out there performing and trying to play at this level. But we will keep our eye on it, and I think the Rockies are a good team to start that experiment, but we'll see. So, Thomas,
yeah, we have
so
enough
much.
Runs as it is, that makes the game longer.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, there's everybody has their issues, but the Rockies are averaging about 3.5 hour games this year at home, and that's a little longer than everyone else, of course, but we'll see. So anyway, Thomas Harding, thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you. Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.